thing was going to happen. And we have attempted to talk to the parents, and they simply turn away. We have asked them to come to counseling with us, and we have offered to pay for it. We have used every resource that we could think of to get some sort of dialogue going. We have simply been turned away and no reason given. It's just, we don't want you.
Was your daughter estranged from you before
she
got married?
No, we were exceptionally close.
And but not only do you not see the grandchildren, but apparently you do not visit even with your daughter, is that it?
No, I have attempted many times to talk to her and say, can we not get together and work on this? And the answer is always, well, we'll see, but there is never any response beyond that.
All right, any questions, Ms. Berard? All right, fine, go ahead. Who's next?
Oh, I'm Maxine Bush, a resident of Lincoln City and a member of the Association of Retired Persons, and have enjoyed the role of a grandparent for 26 years. Grandparents' visitation rights, an issue the members of ARP have wholeheartedly supported for the past 5 years. The ARP State Legislative Committee, acting on behalf of our statewide memberships, endorsed such a bill in 1985. As you know, we lost it. We need a balanced statute, one that will provide step-grandparents as well as maternal and paternal grandparents equal opportunity to seek visitation rights. 1985 statistics show an estimated 1 million children a year experience divorce of their parents. 59% of all marriages end in divorce. Many, and I repeat, many of today's children are born out of wedlock by cohabitating parents who subsequently separate. The latter is a position not presently addressed in existing statutes. There are over 462,000 persons in Oregon over 60. This does not include the number of grandparents in their 40s or 50s. And the national figures state that over 75% in that age group are grandparents. Grandparents' importance to the family increases during times of crises, at which time they become mediators of anxiety and tension and fill the child's need for continuity of care following the marriage dissolution of the child's parents. In fact, they are the best and sometimes only force in stabilizing these situations for the children. In 1983, a joint concurrent resolution, number 45, was placed before the House in Washington by Senator Biagi of New York, calling upon all states to have a uniform grandparents' visitation right act, which provides grandparents with adequate rights to petition state courts for privileges to visit grandchildren. 42 states, as of 1983, statutorily authorized these visitation rights under specified circumstances. The scope of these statutes varies considerably, and they lack uniformity, which presents obstacles for interstate endorsement. None of these statutes give grandparents an absolute right of visitation. Rather, they authorize a grandparent to petition the court asking that such privilege be granted. We're all aware of the confusion surrounding children today's lifestyles, broken homes, step-parents, and step-siblings. In an era where home and security are constantly threatened, who can better uphold the ideals, morals, and temperance of a passing generation than grandparents? Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Council.
Ms. Bush, in your testimony, you allude to children born out of wedlock by cohabiting parents who subsequently separate. As I understand the bill with the House amendments, because paternity isn't necessarily established, you're not legally a grandparent, therefore legally you're not covered by the provision.
You mean in cohabitating circumstances?
That's correct. So there may be a hole under the present formulation of the bill where paternity isn't established, that is, then you would not legally be grandparents, in which you would not be treated by the amendments, at least as I understand them.
Well, I don't know. I would say if you're biologically grandparents, that's the main issue.
I might point out to the chair and the members of the committee, the amendment that's proposed would also cover that group. It would treat them differently,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it would allow grandparents who are grandparents but haven't been adjudged so, at least a window of opportunity under the current bill. If paternity isn't established in that type of situation, there wouldn't be any recourse.
You know, we in my work in ARP, I travel around the state a bit, and I'm in contact with many of our members from around the state. And we hear this from many, many people. These are not isolated cases. There are lots of them. And it should be addressed, and something should be done about it.
All right, thank you. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'm June Foy, Portland, and you have some written testimony from me also. I'm testifying in support of this bill. My interest stems not only from my personal concerns as a grandparent, but from a vital interest in problems of other grandparents in Oregon, many of whom I know. Some are friends of mine who are having trouble. Our law at present just isn't adequate because it doesn't permit, as some of you have pointed out, all grandparents deprived of visitation to petition the court. 14 states do have effective laws that allow any grandparents to appear in court to prove themselves worthy to see their grandchildren. Our personal situation, our daughter and son-in-law were divorced in 84. He gained full custody of their child because our daughter deserted the baby when he was 14 months old. Since then, my husband and I have been very much involved with his care. We would have legal recourse against our son-in-law if he should deny us visitation rights, which he never has. But we'd have no legal rights if our daughter should gain custody of our 6-year-old grandson and then decide to deprive us of contact. Our daughter, a Rajneeshi, considered permanent residence at the ranch when it existed, with plans to pressure her ex-husband into allowing her to take the child with her. Behind the armed guards, he'd been lost to all of us and devastated just as much as we. Though she's living now with her ex-husband and child, we feel the situation will continue to be tenuous because of her emotional troubles. Our love and care have helped that child cope with a disappearing mother and with his obvious hurt and insecurity. He still has nightmares, wets the bed at 6 years old. For his sake and ours, we must continue to be available to him. Grandparents can afford emotional sanctuary. This isn't just about grandparents' rights, it's about these children's rights, grandparents' children's rights. If they're suddenly forbidden to see you, they don't understand why. They think you don't love them. It can leave scars for the rest of their lives. In his book, Love Me, Love Me Not, by Ronald Rohner, an anthropologist, psychologist, he points out that caring grandparents can help reduce the rejection a child feels when a parent is indifferent, impatient, or antagonistic. As for the argument that this kind of bill would cause hard feelings between grandparents and their grown children, I suggest that the hard feelings already exist when decent, responsible grandparents are denied visitation. And I have enough faith in our courts to believe that they would not grant visitation to any grandparent less than decent and responsible. Equally specious to my mind is the argument that more marriages would go down the drain if grandparents demand to see their grandchildren. A marriage that fragile would in all likelihood go down the drain anyway. Besides, the problems, according to experts, in most families seem to surface after a divorce, not before. Thank you for your time and attention.
Questions? All right. Ladies, thank you for being here. And then we have another group of three. I think Representative Campbell has provided us with the names of Hardy Cave, Duane and Sylvia Richardson, and Jim Ferguson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Hardy Cave. I'm a member of the AARP State Legislative Committee and coordinator of the task force in Salem. The board of directors of AARP Chapter 158 in Portland at one of their regular meetings, passed a unanimous resolution authorizing the task force in Salem to represent that chapter and their membership. They ask that we please support the grandparents' visitation legislation as encompassed in House Bill 3197 and its amendments, and any relative legislation or statute changes that places all grandparents on an equal footing before the laws of the state. The existing laws offer little or nothing in the event of marital separations, which in today's world is often the case. These divorces or separations, usually of long periods, have a devastating impact on the emotional life of the children. Other members of the family have a high concern for the children and at times are not allowed such visitations. The children need to know of the loving concern of other members of the family, particularly grandparents, and especially at such times of distress when they have a loss of a parent or death, divorce, and so forth is the case. Oregon statutes need to be changed to reflect today's changing situations in family relations. Chapter in Portland and all AARP membership in Oregon urge your support of House Bill 3197 and its passage. And I thank you very much.
All right, Mr. Cave. Who's next, please?
My name is Dwayne Richardson, and this is my wife, Sylvia. And we are here to support Bill 3197. And I'd like to point out some of the problems we're having, and so that perhaps you'll understand why we're in favor of this bill. Our daughter and son-in-law are still married, and they have two grandchildren, a boy that is 7 and a girl that is almost 11. And we have not been permitted to see them for 4 years, except a couple of times happenstance where we met on the street or at some occasion. But any time that we have called, we've been told that we shouldn't call again. Don't call anymore. We don't want you to see the children. And they we are the people who our daughter and son-in-law want us to deed them some property as part of getting to see the grandchildren. The last time I talked to my daughter, well, I talked to her on the phone, and I said, "What do you mean you're holding the grandchildren hostage then for property?" And she said, "Yes, that's right." And we happen to live in a area which is EFU 20, and so if we were to deed them any property at all from our farm, it would have to be 20 acres. And we feel that with their actions at this time, if we did deed them some property, there would be no assurance that they would respect that as our good faith to get to see the grandchildren, and they could turn right around and do the same thing as they are now and sell the property and be gone anyway. So we have decided against deeding the property, and we've taken this avenue to hope that you will see fit to give us the opportunity to petition the courts and let them decide if we have the right to see our grandchildren or not.
All right, Mr. Richardson, thank you. Did Mrs. Richardson want to add anything to that?
Only that this should take into consideration the grandchildren's position in this turmoil.
And does your daughter live in the Junction City area?
Well, they live in Springfield. We're not allowed to give Christmas presents, birthday presents. We can't even talk to them on the phone. Anything that we have sent through the mail, we've been told, is thrown in the trash.
And this has been going on for about 4 years now, you say?
Yes. We've tried counseling. We've tried everything we know how to do. And it's always been turned down.
And you have reason to believe that that's the reason that this problem exists, and because they want the property.
Not necessarily.
That's the thing they're using now.
That's what they're using now. And we would deed that property if they would honor that. But that wouldn't be we don't feel that's the end. It'd be something else.
All right. Any questions of the Richardsons? All right, thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Well, Mr. Fry, I want to thank you very much, the chairman for the and the committee for entertaining our review of this this situation.
Put your name on the record for
us. I'm Jim Ferguson, 1565 Southwest Highland Parkway, Portland, Oregon. I'm going to skip most of my testimony here because it primarily concerns my situation. You've seen enough or heard enough of this matter, which is pretty much the whole story of what we're worrying about. I happen to have 5 grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren. I love all of them. They love me. I can't help but say that that's a great idea that they do. It has an awful lot of joy in my life. But enough of that. In my chore as chairman of the State Legislative Committee for AARP in the last 5 years, I've gotten around a lot of the state, and I've had dozens and dozens and dozens of calls statewide and in Portland concerning the plight of the grandparents seeking the right to visit with their grandchildren because of divorce, death of the spouse, vindictiveness of the parents squabbling over money in many cases, or other spiteful or petty reasons. More than half of these people have no remedy when they ask me what can they do under the existing law. They simply are foreclosed out. Now, there's a great amount of unhappiness out there. The children are anxious. They can't see their grandchildren. The grandparents are unhappy. They can't see the children in many instances. If they do, it's just a terrible tragedy. Now, we have no way of placing a precise figure on the amount of the anguish, but 70% of all adults over age 45 are grandparents. And today's divorce rate, which runs up to 50% on these newcomers and these newlyweds, pretty much tells the story in terms of the situation. It's a national tragedy. Nationally, it's been recognized by the media, it's been recognized by the Congress. The present situation is just impossible. We've got to do something about it, and you have the opportunity to take it out to the Senate. Most people have worked out these problems of their parental and grandparents' visitation, if they have a problem. But some just simply have to rely on a court, an experienced judge who understands what the situation is and can do what is best for the children and well of the family. That's all the law, that's what we all ask for. If the law, in every case, they have required that they take into account the children's situation. Now, potentially, only half of the family caught up in these dilemmas are able to do anything at all under the existing Oregon statute. This has been an issue that's been on before this committee, before this session, and ever since the law was passed in 79. There have been efforts to try to correct it. Basically, what we're trying to do is to get both families on the same footing. From after that, we can worry about some minor details. Now, I have one little quote here from the director of the National Institute of the Families, Reverend Donald Conroy, who says that the grandparents are our country's great forgotten resource on family relationships. We need their skills and perspective. Grandparents and grandchildren need each other. Now, this bill is not totally the whole bill. It's not going to solve all the problem, but it goes a long way to solving the problem that we have here around among our members, among a lot of the grandparents throughout the state. You have heard some of the situation here. I just simply ask you to pass this out as a due pass recommendation, and thank you very much for your
time. All right, Jim, thank you. Any questions, Mr. Ferguson? All right, thank all of you for being here, and let me make an inquiry now. Judge Norbott, are you here on just this one bill? Okay, then I won't worry about whether I call you right away or not. I'll call Roger Feit next, please.
My case settled anyway, so.
How come you're not on a golf course? They say that's what judges do when their cases settle on Sunday afternoons in Salem. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Roger Feit. My wife and I have been foster parents for approximately the past 8 years. The foster children we've had have been in permanent planning, so most of them have gone after a period of time with us to a permanent adoption. We've had eight foster children during that period. I'd like to read you a brief statement from a foster child who is now living with us. May I omit her name from the record? Is it necessary to enter her name in the record?
Not if you don't want it.
It's a statement from her. I'm 12 years old. I have been in foster care for over 3 years. I have one younger brother and two younger sisters that I lived with for most of my life. My father is dead. I don't know where my mother is. Because I have been mistreated, I sometimes don't behave the way that some adults think I should, but I am learning. I like school and have very good grades. I like basketball and track. I am getting along very well in my current foster home. I have never had any problems with the law. I am available for adoption, but I want to be adopted with my brother and two sisters. I have always thought we could grow up together. That is what CSD thought best, but foster parents that we lived with asked CSD to take all of us except our little sister away. They used the law you are working on to ask the court to let them keep our little sister. I don't know very much about how the law works, but I know what it feels like to have a sister taken away. I know what it feels like to be told that it is time to say goodbye to your little sister forever. I understand this bill would change the law so that the feelings of brothers and sisters would be considered in deciding what to do with kids. I don't think that is good enough. I think the law should say that brothers and sisters should stay together, if at all possible. I understand that this bill would give adults more ways to try to get kids like my sister away from her brothers and sisters. In my case, what CSD wanted was what was best for my family, but other people had too much power. They were able to keep CSD from doing what was best. I think it is wrong to give other adults even more power. And she wanted to come say this to you herself, but she and I realized that it was too painful for her to have to do that. There are a couple other points that I would like to make. I think there are two main issues with this bill. The first is I think the bill should focus on families. ORS 109.119 makes no mention of siblings. House Bill 3197 mentions siblings, but it does not have a family orientation. For example, a family may have an especially needy child, and those needs may be so great that the impact on the family as a whole and on the other children may simply be more than is reasonable. They're tough decisions, but I think a parent must look not only at what's in the best interest of that child, but look at what's in the best interest of the family. By the same token, we may have a child in a family that is exceptional and might go to an Ivy League school, but at the expense of the other children having to put themselves through community college. Would a parent consider only what's best for the one child, or would the parent consider what's best for all of the children? I think when the state presumes to be a parent, it should act similarly and not focus on what is in the best interest of this child and allow people to come in and focus the court's attention on only one child. I think the law should require that the courts focus on what is the best interest of this family of children. The other point I'd like to make is that I think children need some insulation from the political and financial power of adults. With these particular kids, I saw CSD paralyzed to inaction. They hung on every word that a judge uttered in various hearings. They agonized over whether taking the action that they thought they should take would anger the judge. They agonized over whether or not the state administrators in CSD would support them if they did what they felt to be in the best interest of these children. I think what we really must want is what's best for kids, and not what will make the most adults or the most powerful adults happy. I think this bill should not apply to the issue of wardship or to other matters in juvenile court, because it will cause CSD to pay too much attention to the desires of adults and not enough attention to what is in the best interest of the kids. And finally, I just want to say that I do strongly support the requirement that in the case of foster parents, the period of time be a minimum of 3 years before they would have standing under this bill, because there are many, many foster children that remain in the system for more than 2 years and simply provides too many opportunities for people to petition in the same way that they did with these children.
Thank you. Any questions? All right, Mr. Fite, thank you for being here. Wanda Romberg.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, just to put the past witness's testimony in perspective, the portion of the bill that describes to the court the standards it needs to consider is on page 3 of the amendments, lines 37 to 40. And to provide some further perspective, foster parents are treated differently than grandparents. They're within the psychological parent section of the amendments on page 2, beginning line 11.
Thank you, Counselor. Go ahead.
I'm Wanda Romberg, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I am the grandmother of 4 children and one little granddaughter who's just a half granddaughter, but we've always treated her as though she was our granddaughter too. For 5.5 years, my husband and I furnished all the food, all of the clothing, all of the furniture, all of the medical care, taking the children to church, and taking care of all of their needs. And after 5.5 years, the foster father, or the stepfather, decided that he would deny us these privileges and cut us off from seeing our grandchildren.
Excuse me.
Yes, Senator Cohen.
I need to clarify, the foster father or the stepfather?
He was the stepfather. At that time, he did not have custody of the children, and he filed under the psychological law and got the grandchildren under the psychological law.
So he was a stepfather and then filed?
He was a stepfather to one and the real father to the other one.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Helps me.
My husband and I took the children to church, and we'd sit up with them at night when they were ill and sat with them in the hospital. When one little girl was taken to the hospital, I was the only maternal influence in the girls' lives. The mother left when one child was 8 months old and the other little child was 3 years old. And even to today, there is no maternal parent in that home. There is no woman to see to the needs of these little children. These little girls were very emotionally upset and needed this one-to-one contact that my husband and I could provide for them, and we felt it very important to be a part of their lives. The stepfather took this right away from us, so I petitioned the court under the psychological grandparent to get the right, just the right to see my grandchildren, that I could have, my husband and I could have the privilege of having a designated time that we could see these little children. And when we went to court, we qualified for all of the requirements, but was denied the right to see these children under the psychological law. And I feel that it should be changed because we feel the importance of having these little children. We feel important, we think it's important that they need this nourishment and this one-to-one contact that a grandparent has with these little children. And we wish that this law could be changed because we feel that it's important that these little children have the same rights and the same benefits that their parents had of having this love and this companionship.
Any questions of Ms. Romberg? Senator Cohen.
If we broaden the psychological parent, and I need to look more carefully at that, wouldn't that strengthen the stepfather's
on the development of the case plan? Whatever the reason, the needs and rights of the child and society require that the juvenile courts, which do in fact oversee CSD, have the authority to order that these services be provided. Without the clarifications made by this bill, CSD has substantially unfettered discretion in whether to provide services and treatment. Such unfettered discretion is not only harmful to children and their families, it is also inconsistent with the strong legislative trend toward more oversight of CSD by the juvenile courts. In recent years, the legislature has imposed many duties on the juvenile court in its efforts to protect children whom the courts have committed to the care of Children's Services Division. The legislature has given children a statutory right to treatment, has given the court the duty to protect the best interests of the child. The legislature has permitted the court in 419-507 to require CSD to prepare and submit to the court a treatment plan. The legislature has given the court continuing jurisdiction to protect the rights of the child and the parents. The legislature has required the juvenile court to review the cases and case plans and monitor services being provided by Children's Services Division in cases before the court at numerous intervals. Those reviews can be conducted whenever the child, parent, or juvenile court basically wants a review. And even if no one wants a review, those reviews must be conducted periodically, as often as every 6 months. The legislature has also created citizen review boards as an arm of the juvenile courts. The citizen review boards conduct reviews and of cases to provide oversight and monitoring. They themselves have no authority, and their only authority is what they gain through the court by making their recommendations to the court. And this session, the legislature may create court-appointed special advocates, which also will oversee and monitor CSD, among other things, and report to the court, not having any authority of their own. Thus, it is clear that there has been much movement in the direction of fettering CSD's discretion. Most of that movement has placed the juvenile court in a monitoring role over CSD. These legislative changes have cost the state substantially and increased judicial time spent in such monitoring tasks. They are laudable efforts, but they are, in my view, pointless unless the court has the authority to effectuate the changes that are required in individual cases. In addition to the legislature giving children a statutory right to treatment, the state and federal courts have found a substantial statutory constitutional right to treatment. Children also have a constitutional and statutory right to be placed in the least restrictive alternative. Without a clarification that the juvenile court has the authority to enforce these rights, they are rights without a remedy. House Bill 3013 is not only consistent with the Oregon statutory scheme, legislative policy, and state and federal constitutional law, it is also similar to statutes and court rules in numerous other states. I won't go into detail in these. They are set out in my analysis at pages 11 to 15. And in the analysis, I cite two statutory and rule provisions from Wisconsin, New York, California, Florida, Montana, Washington, Tennessee, South Carolina, and the District of Columbia. In addition to references to other state statute, there is analysis of current case law in Oregon, which I think very strongly supports this bill, in the written analysis that I have submitted. I would like to close by addressing some concerns that have been raised by CSD about this bill. First of all, they are concerned that the bill will result in an increased expenditure of money beyond that which has been budgeted for them by the legislature. I think it is clear under the In re L case, which is in your materials, and under the constitutional doctrine of separation of powers, that that cannot occur. 3013 does not attempt to change the constitutional prohibition against the judiciary attempting to order the executive branch to exceed budgetary limitations imposed upon it by the legislature. And if it did attempt to do so, it could not be effective because that is constitutional law as interpreted by the courts of this state. That basic separation of powers doctrine is set out in the In re L case. And it starts at towards the end of the opinion at page 268. The opinion is in your materials. It's the second from the last item in your materials. The practical effect of this is that if the court wished to order a child placed, say, in foster care and CSD said we have no more money for foster care, however unlikely that might be, then the court could not make that order under the separation of powers doctrine. It could not require CSD to exceed the limit that the legislature had set in its budget. I also include in the materials a continuum of care chart, and it's the last two pages in the bound materials. That was originally submitted to the House Committee on this bill. And it, by CSD, I think it shows that, in fact, we do have a pretty good continuum of care in Oregon and that it's not going to be necessary to go outside of the budgetary limitations set by the legislature because the legislature has funded that continuum of care. Thus, CSD's concern that they can be required as a result of 3013 to spend money not budgeted to them is really groundless. And the alternative, which is what CSD asked the committee to do, which is to trust that they are currently supplying the best available services within budgetary limitations in every case, just is not borne out by the experience of people who work in the system. CSD is also concerned that 3013 will blur the roles of CSD in the courts, that judges are not social workers and should not be making such decisions. I think that this position betrays a basic misunderstanding of the adversarial process that the legislature has implemented in these juvenile cases. The courts hear these cases. They hear the testimony of expert psychiatrists, psychologists, and other experts, as well as non-expert witnesses. They hear the testimony of the Children's Services Division worker, and then the judge does what she is uniquely qualified to do, weighs the evidence and applies the standards set out in the statute and case law and makes a decision. And all we are asking is that that process be effectuated in this bill. Lastly, CSD raises concerns about losing federal funding as a result of 3013. I believe that upon examination, the committee will see that this claim is extremely attenuated from the statute in question, and CSD is really stretching to try to come up with something to oppose this bill. The concern arises from some language in Public Law 96272. The committee is probably familiar with Public Law 96272. It was one of the main motivators in the Citizen Review Board legislation and a number of the statutes that I've already cited to you requiring regular periodic reviews of CSD cases by the juvenile courts. It is a bill that was passed by Congress when Congress found massive misuse of the child foster care system and to the great harm of many children in this country. The purpose, overriding purpose of Public Law 96272 is to put into place a system of monitoring state agencies and to require more judicial oversight of state agencies. And perhaps the committee will remember legislation two sessions ago, which required that the courts make reasonable efforts determinations in these cases. That came directly out of Public Law 96272. The statute in question is 42 U.S.C. Section 672A2. I wrote it out for you so you could meditate on it, as I have for many hours, trying to figure out how CSD has gotten to the place that they're at with this statute. A complete analysis of this statute and the issue of whether or not the court having authority to make specific orders in cases could result in loss of federal funds has been done by the National Center for Youth Law, and that analysis is attached to my analysis, which is in your materials. The analysis of the National Center concludes, I think correctly, that there is nothing in the federal statutory language under Title 4E of the Social Security Act, which is 96272, the federal implementing regulations of Title 4E, its legislative history or policy statements by the Department of Health and Human Services, which would preclude eligibility for federal foster care payments for a court ward for whom the juvenile court had ordered specific services. I think the suggestion that the court, by directing CSD to provide services needed to protect the child or to effectuate the child's right to treatment, is thereby taking over responsibility for the child's care and placement is just ridiculous. The court has no financial resources of its own for care or placement. All such services are provided by CSD or its contractors, which CSD supervises and certifies. And the court does not have the time to be responsible for the case service provision in these individual cases. I believe that CSD has or will supply you with a letter from HHS concerning HB 3013. I have seen a draft of this letter, and it is based on the original draft of House Bill 3013 before the House amendments. Those House amendments were drafted specifically to address the concerns raised in the draft letter, and specifically, as you can see, incorporate the language of 42 U.S.C. 672. Clearly, the provisions of House Bill 3013 are more closely consistent with 42 U.S.C. 672 than many of the provisions of the other state statutes and rules that I have cited in my analysis. The committee should pass House Bill 3013 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and make it clear that the juvenile courts have the authority to hold CSD accountable for the services it provides to children in this state, not because California, Washington, New York, Wisconsin, Florida, Montana, Tennessee, South Carolina, and Washington, D.C. give such authority to their juvenile courts, but rather because it is...
How do those states fund their juvenile courts and the services provided?
I think it varies. I don't know the answer.
Get that information for me.
I can try.
You know, somewhere along before the end of the session. I don't necessarily...
The issue is do you continue to get... reimbursement.
No, I'm not talking about that issue. I'm talking about another issue because I am concerned that the state is now assuming the costs for every felon. Now we're assuming the costs No, I'm looking to give some of those costs back to the local courts and the local counties, and I'm wondering whether the whole juvenile issue is not one that we want to take another look at seriously. So I'm interested in the funding issue and that whole thing in those other states.
We can take a look at that for you.
Just to respond to that, several years ago in the Governor's Task Force on Corrections, they did a study, and it's my recollection that at that time, CSD's budget was approximately $215 million. The juvenile departments throughout the state added up to approximately $30 million, and Juvenile Services Commission was, I think, 6.5. So that was the approximate ratio. That's about 3 years ago.
That was it. I think you interrupted me right in the middle of my punchline.
There's no glad to
do. Sorry. I thought you were either having that whole page to go or...
Ms. Norblad?
No, I have nothing to add. I think Julie's done an outstanding job. I understand she's provided you with a letter from Stephen Harrell, Judge Harrell, dated May 13th. We had an executive committee meeting on March 24th. Unanimously, the Judges and Directors Association voted to support this. We had another meeting approximately 2 weeks ago wherein there were 20 directors, about 14 judges. This matter was again supported. So the judges and directors support this, and we feel that there should be some independent review of what CSD does and independent accountability.
Question?
Mr. Chair, Julie, I've been sitting reading U.S. Department in your handout, I assume, the response to policy interpretation questions, which I think stems from CSD's concern that the potential of us losing $1 million+ for the biennium. And looking at the letter dated April 1, it does speak to the proposed amendments in 3013. And there's still some concern as far as the potential loss of funds, because clearly responsibility for the placement and care of the foster child must remain with the state agency, one spot. And certainly the courts are not, let's see, where did I say it? I like the bill, but I certainly don't want to chance jeopardizing.
One of the things that's interesting, and this is, HEW has taken this position in the past, Region 10, is the fact that the courts in Washington and California have much stronger control over placement than this particular legislation. And they've never taken funding away. And in fact, in California, it's almost complete control over child placement. And HEW, in particular Region 10, has never done anything about
it. And they've never...
No.
So it's somehow the responsibility still sits with the agency, per se, because at least the interpretation of their responses, that's clear. It must remain with CSD. But... Mm-hmm.
If I could respond to that, Senator Hamby, I haven't seen the second letter.
April 1.
I think that there are a couple of reasons why we're not in danger of losing any federal funds. One is that specifically in the bill we say that the responsibility stays with CSD. We also say that the court is only allowed to order the specific type of placement rather than to order the placement. And you cannot have a case plan that is so general as to only order a specific type of placement. So I do not think...
I know, Zach, and I'm comfortable with it, Julie. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Cohen, did you have any questions?
Yes, I'm interested in how much we know in terms of oversight of placement. And I'm increasingly concerned about spending of money. I want to talk about the how much are we spending now on the advisory committees?
Citizen review boards?
Yes. Aren't they supposed to? I mean, now we're going to have them reviewing, and then we have the judges reviewing. And I just want, I'm now, you know, all of a sudden we've all jumped on the bandwagon and say review, review, review. And it seems to me that if we've got the judges, maybe we ought to do the judges. Fund the juvenile court judges better and wipe out the advisory committee or whatever you call them. I'm very concerned about all of this sort of proliferation and nobody doing anything with kids.
There, if I could respond, their budget is in excess of $900,000 for next biennium to fund the whole state.
Just kind of look over the shoulder of CSD again.
Well, the problem is they can review it and I can review it, but we can't make any changes in the plan, and that's what this legislation deals with. As far as Citizens Review, I've supported Citizens Review. I had a trial this afternoon that went off, but this morning I did 27 juvenile cases. About half of those are neglect and abuse. Last count I did, working 2.5 days a week. I did 450 cases in February. The fact is, that's really not fair to anybody, and I'm not really getting into them in any depth. I think the beauty of Citizen Review is they can spend half hour, 45 minutes to an hour, and really get into them. Unless you're willing to increase judicial funding so that I can do a lot less cases, I think there has to be other alternatives.
I'm interested in looking at that.
If I could respond to that, too. I think it would be very good to look at the review system. I think that the citizen review boards are pretty cost-effective, but bottom line is as long as someone's conducting the reviews and CSD doesn't just have unfettered discretion to do what they want, I don't care who reviews the cases. What I want is an effective review form, and we don't have that now. I think this bill will go a long way towards doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you both. Representative Bauman, you can come up and start by responding to Senator Cohen if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Judy Bauman, and I thought I had the answer to Senator Cohen's question, and I realized it was a different bill I carried. We just carried a bill related to Citizens Review Board. It's interesting what the atmosphere in the House is as far as the accountability of Children's Services Division, and I have some concerns about some of the wave of feelings, which I think that this bill and others may be identified with, and I think I heard the main portion of Julie McFarland's testimony. She is the spirit behind the bill, and I think that she answered the concerns that this is some kind of a knee-jerk backlash reaction to the Children's Services Division. It certainly isn't. And my real intense interest in 3013, and I am intensely interested in following the success of the bill or in answering any questions that I can for the committee members on the bill, is related both to my own experience as an attorney in working on some of these cases and more recently as a legislator concerned with the ability of Children's Services Division to do its job effectively. One note for the committee on history, and then I think you've probably heard plenty about the bill, but I carried the bill on the House floor where it passed unanimously. And I was surprised that it passed unanimously because there was a very negative legislative fiscal report that I felt was based on some incomplete information. But after I carried the bill, I received a note from a person who had tracked juvenile bills in the 1975-1977 sessions. And in Senate Bill 2, which was, I believe, in the 77 session, there was a provision in that bill that the courts could order the placement of children, very similar to this bill. CSD raised the same arguments that it's raising now, contending that the state was going to lose millions of federal dollars. The bill passed in the Senate, and it failed to pass in the House. Again, in 1979, Senate Bill 111, the result of the Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Corrections, gave the court the right of placement. CSD made the same arguments. The bill passed both houses and was vetoed by the governor. My experience as an attorney tells me that there are frustrating times when the court would like to make CSD more effective in what CSD is doing in a particular case. And I think that because of the frustration in the allocation of some accountability, the attitude of that agency is we don't have to pay any attention to what the court says. And there's a long history of that. I'm supporting the bill, obviously. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has. Must be getting tired at this point.
Excuse us.
Okay.
Oh, that's not a problem, Senator Cohen. I wasn't referring to that. I really was fascinated by the testimony that I heard earlier, and I would defer to Judge Norblad and to Julie McFarland, actually. If you still have questions, they should probably come up and answer them rather than me.
It was excellent testimony, excellent materials. So,
I thought so, too. Thank you, Senator Hamby. I'm not taking the compliment personally. I'm
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you for being
thank
here.
You.
Now, in the face of losing a quorum here in a minute, I got one more witness, Gail Arkley, who represents CSD on this bill.
I have agreed to miss my bus, but I've also made arrangements to catch a ride with counsel.
Okay, because I think that there.
Okay, as long as.
All right, fine. Then I think we can either. Well, okay, then let's hear from Gail Arkley. Then we'll stay right on the same bill. We'll get the CSD version now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gail Arkley. I'm the manager of the Resource and Regulatory Section of Children's Services Division. I think you, Julie, fairly well summarized Children's Services Division's position from previous testimony presented to the House Committee. I think you have my prepared testimony before you. Essence of time, I'd be glad to answer your questions or address specific concerns. My testimony is fairly brief. Whatever.
Okay. Any questions of the witness here? Okay, well.
You might be interested in knowing that we have consulted with Region 10 regarding the amendments that were specifically drafted to address our concerns regarding the loss of federal funds. And they have informed us that the amendments, in their view, and in the view of their central office, do not solve that problem because the court is still involved in case planning functions, which, according to Public Law 96272, need to be the responsibility of the state agency. So our concern remains the same, that we would hypothetically, if a series of cases with directive court orders were to come through, that we would not be able to open for eligibility cases on those. And even if a very small number were to come through, we just hypothesized the possibility of maybe 13 4E potentially eligible cases per month with court orders that directed services, we could indeed lose possibly $1 million in federal funds. Our concerns, I think, still do remain the same about the possibility of finding ourselves directed to provide some very expensive services that might not take us over our total budget, but would readjust our line item budgets internally and interfere with legislatively approved budgets and priorities. So that still remains a concern.
There's been no loss of funds experienced by either, let's say, California.
I really can't address that. I don't know about the history of other states. I did talk to our staff person in the Region 10 office, and they continually get questions about other states are establishing laws that do give the courts more power, and other states are supposedly not losing federal funds. And she said that in consultation with the Central Office of Health and Human Services that their procedures are correct. In other words, if they tell us that they would declare an audit exception and would disallow federal funds, that would occur. I don't know what has happened in California. That's not Region 10, where, our region is.
There are no other states in Region 10.
No, Region 10 includes.
That have enacted.
Yeah, I really can't address that because I don't know.
Have you ever corresponded with Region 10 in writing on this?
Not on the amendments. I did ask them to get back to me if they had anything further that they wanted to say other than the telephone conversation that I made when they were first presented. I later, as you say, I did send them a letter including those amendments.
Right, and you've never heard from Region 10 in writing?
Not regarding those amendments,
okay.
No.
Well, of course, I always prefer to see some claim made about what the feds are going to do or not do. I'd like to see that in the form of a letter or communication from the federal government rather than relying upon just being told that. So, if you get something in writing, let us know, and I appreciate seeing what you said in your letter to Region 10, frankly. I'd really appreciate seeing that.
I believe that is
in the file?
In the packet that I delivered
that in
to
the file.
Committee.
That's the one that you're talking about. Okay, fine.
Yes. However, Mr. Chair, I do note in Julie's material, page 13 and 14, Washington Code, a reference to Washington Revised Code section that requires, the statute requires review by the court of the status of all dependent children at least every 6 months. So.
All right, thank you then.
I assume Washington's in Region 10 still.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
still.
Still is. All right, I think that takes care of all the witnesses on House Bill 3013.